Well, thanks, Annalise, and welcome to Centennial Hall at the Milwaukee Public Library for the culminating event in the Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison, brought to you by WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, and Milwaukee Public Television. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joanne Williams. For the past 6 months, we've been exploring the causes and the impacts of the Milwaukee area's high rate of incarceration among African-American men. And now we're looking for solutions. For the next 2 hours, we'll hear from people with a variety of perspectives on what will make a difference.
We'll meet those people in just a few minutes, but first, we know this is an issue that many people are familiar with, but we wanted to frame this evening's discussion with a story that was produced before our series even got underway by a media outlet that you might not expect to cover this issue. Last year, a crew from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, traveled to Wisconsin. Here's Joanne introducing an airing of the BBC feature for the MPTV series, Black Nouveau.
Wisconsin has the highest incarceration rate for black males in the United States, almost double the national average. Why and what needs to be done has attracted international attention. Franz Strassen of the British Broadcasting Corporation produced this video.
Not over 90% of the perpetrators of homicide in this city are African American. call upon him to do something.
Well, because this is such, you can give them a hand. And it makes you wonder why the BBC had to come here to tell us this problem. But because this is such a large issue, we've divided tonight's event into two separate panel discussions. The first featuring the guests you see here. The second will feature a panel of five. Here are the guests for the first half of tonight's program.
Andre Brown is case manager for Project Return, which helps former inmates with employment, housing, substance abuse, and other services. Brown is a former inmate and the founder and president of Citizens for Urban Peace, an outreach ministry.
Michael Hafman is the superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Correction. It houses 420 prisoners and monitors about 300 others through electronic surveillance. He's made inmate programming a priority, ranging from work release to getting your GED.
State Senator Nakia Harris is a Democrat from Milwaukee, elected to the Senate in 2012. She represents the 6th District on the city's north side, which has some of the state's highest rates of black male incarceration and black male unemployment.
Nathan Holton is coordinator of the Milwaukee Community Justice Council, an umbrella organization of criminal justice agencies, elected officials, and other leaders. The council analyzes the justice system and makes recommendations with the goal of ensuring that it is fair, efficient, and effective.
State Representative Rob Hutton is a Republican from Brookfield who was elected in 2012. He's volunteered with inner city and prison outreach ministries and believes the state must address the prison and recidivism rate with a comprehensive plan for, quote, how we sentence nonviolent offenders and how we return ex-offenders as productive members of society.
And Lois Quinn is a senior scientist with UWM's Employment and Training Institute and co-author of the study that showed Wisconsin has the nation's highest rate of black male incarceration. The study also revealed that more than half of the African-American men in their 30s in Milwaukee County have spent time in state prisons.
The goal of this town hall forum is to bring our audience members into the conversation as quickly as possible. But to start our discussion, we'd like each of you on the panel in 1 to 2 minutes, and we're timing you, to address the single most important solution you believe will make a difference in helping solve the problem of this high rate of incarceration among black men in our community.
Now, when it comes to this topic, everybody has an opinion, and everybody may have an answer. But nobody has the answer, because the problem is just too big to have just one solution. So we need many suggestions tonight on what to do. But they have to be concrete solutions, things that we can work on tomorrow and in the next few days and months thereafter, things that will make a difference tomorrow. We'll start with Andre Brown. Mr.
Yes.
Brown, what do you think is the one biggest obstacle to bringing these statistics down?
Well, it is a big issue, but to simplify the issue, there's two parts to this, Joanne, that I believe are the cause and that could be the solution. One is society at large. Let's look at our government when it comes to opportunity. And this sentiment has been echoed through history. I mean, this is a historical statement. Opportunity and resources for these neighborhoods. That's what needs to be in these neighborhoods from a government standpoint. And from the business community, there has to be a sense of forgiveness and a sense of working with the ex-offender. There can't be an attitude of we have to keep the ex-offender at bay because of the stigma. The business community has to include the ex-offender, this population. And society as a whole has to provide some form of forgiveness. So right there, historically, the content in that has always been there. Historically, the African-American has always been kept out of the employment market, has always been in prison. So this has a historical tone to it. And so this makes the situation has to be a concentrated effort on the African-American situation. And you can make it your own segment on just the African-American situation. But, you know, when it comes to this situation, society, government, the business community, and people at large have to input some sense of forgiveness.
Well, let's ask Representative Hutton, what do you think? In one minute.
One to 2 minutes. We'll give
maybe
you.
Two.
I was going to say, that's pretty tough for a politician. But thank you for having me, by the way. And I was just thinking through as I was coming up here in the podium to think that, number one, I'm a white guy, in case you haven't noticed. I'm from the burbs, and I have I had a great third point. I'm also a politician, so I'm white, I'm from the burbs, and I'm a politician. If that isn't three strikes and you're out for me, I don't know what is. But it's a privilege to be up here and to actually be a part of this discussion. Joanne, I'm so appreciative of the fact that you are saying the obvious, that there is no one answer to this issue. It is extremely complex. I think as I've spent the time in the community and have spent years involved in prison outreach, you know, you leave those prisons with two fundamental questions. Number one is you ask the question of those that you rub shoulders with, how in the world did they get here? And what was the road that they took that landed them in this situation? And for those inmates that you talk to that are going to be out in a week or a month or a few years, you ask the next question is, what are the realities that they're going to exceed expectation and actually be able to sustain being free post their incarceration? And it is very telling to me, those that we're able to talk to really follow two paths, leaving our penitentiaries and our institutions. Those that say, I'm going to leave with a shirt on my back and a few quarters, make a few phone calls, and I'm going to cross my fingers and hope that it works. And those that say, I have a plan because I've been able to reengage with either family or an organization that is going to come alongside me, support me, mentor me, disciple me, and connect me back in the community that will actually give me a fighting chance to stay out of the situation, to not go back in a few years, in a few months, and actually be a contributing member of society. And I spent the last few days just meeting with a few organizations that, again, don't profess to have all the answers, but are doing the little things, engaging those inmates with very, very deliberate steps and programs that are giving them a light at the end of the tunnel to break this chain of recidivism and give them a fighting chance to reconnect with not only their families, but also with the business community. And those are the steps that we need to be taking.
You saw me reach for the bell there, I think.
Yes, thank you.
Well, and hopefully we'll be able to drill down into some of what some of those programs and services are as the evening goes on.
Right.
But let's continue along the line, and perhaps let's hear from Michael Haifman. What's the one single most important aspect to doing something about this issue?
If I had to pick one important aspect, I think to realize that the old practices are simply warehousing people, putting them in jail in a correctional facility and not providing them any opportunity to improve themselves while they're in custody doesn't work. It's been done in the past. And the results are where we are today. One of the things we've done since I've taken over the House of Corrections, we brought back educational programming. We've brought back a community work crews, AODA issues. We've expanded our industry so inmates who are working within the facility can gain skills. We have certification programs. One is very simple, inexpensive to run, where inmates can be certified in how to operate a forklift. And so they're going to leave custody with a certification that says they're state certified to be a forklift operator. And again, these are small steps we can make, but the main issue I'd like to make is we have to do something. And there is not one solution. There's not one programming. What works in another community in another state might not necessarily work in Milwaukee. So you have to tailor it for our needs here, specific to our population. That's one thing we're striving to do as we move forward.
Thank you. Nathan Holton.
Thanks for having me. In terms of a single solution, of course, there is none. We all know that. But the first thing that we need to do, I think, is focus on the fact that black male incarceration is a symptom of a much larger problem that involves society. In my last position, I went into prisons and represented offenders who were going to be coming out in the next few months from the time that I would see them. And there were a set of attributes that I noticed that were common for pretty much everybody that I represented. The first is that they were raised in poverty. The second one is that they were high school dropouts generally, or even grade school dropouts. The third thing is that they generally experienced trauma as a youth. They grew up in a difficult environment, a tough household, an area that featured concentrated poverty, and that has long-lasting effects on people. The last thing is that they usually came from a single-parent household. These are all things that we need to discuss, and things that we need to do something about if we truly want to do something about this issue. The reason that Wisconsin, in my opinion, has the highest black male incarceration rate in the country is because of those four very issues. Wisconsin's ranks number one in the percent of black children who live in poverty. Our educational outcomes in Milwaukee, where most of the black population lives, are not very good. We have severe trauma that's based on concentrated poverty because Milwaukee is highly segregated both in terms of race and in terms of income. And Wisconsin is number one in the percent of black children who live in single-parent households. Those facts and the black male incarceration fact are related, and we need to have a very serious discussion about that, and we need to have an honest discussion about that.
Well, as we mentioned, this is designed to be an interactive town hall meeting. You're not just going to sit there and listen. We want to hear from you, although we will be timing you. We'll start taking questions in just a few minutes. WUWM's Bonnie North is in the audience, and she has the microphone, the lady in the yellow T-shirt. If you have a question, raise your hand, and she will meet you at the aisle next to where you are sitting. So get your questions ready. Before we go to you, let's go to State Senator Nakia Harris and find out what politicians can do about this. Explain it in a minute.
Explain in a minute?
Sure.
All right. Well, first of all, I do appreciate being on the panel on this evening. And I'll just, you know, like I think we've all agreed that there is no one way to handle this problem in our community. But it's a multifaceted approach that we have to take. And one of the ways to do that is making sure that we are reducing the population, the prison population, in half, hopefully by 2015. Now, we know that that's a far stretch, but there are ways that we can start to accomplishing that goal. And one way is by making sure that there are programs like treatment and aversion programs in the community, and that they are well-funded so that people who are nonviolent offenders who may have an addiction can get the treatment that they deserve and need. And so we really have an issue where we have to resolve it quickly so that we can put families back together. One of my biggest issues is with our educational system is that we don't have black men in the homes, and we wonder why our kids are failing in school, and we wonder why they're acting out. And the reason is because they don't have their fathers at home. They don't have, you know, a father who is taking care of them, who can get a job. Another issue is banning the box so that they can have access to employment and get them back into society. So we really have a lot of work to do, and I think that we are on the right track when we put, when the state senate, state legislature has put money back into the in programs like treatment and diversion, but we have a long way to go. And so it's good that we're having a conversation right now.
Lois Quinn wrote the report that got things rolling, I guess you could say that. But did you find anything that really surprised you when you looked at the statistics?
I was overwhelmed. Overwhelmed. I don't think I found anything that the black community didn't already know. But when we added up and we had the prison file of everybody who had been in prison, we had 95,000 men of working age who had been in state prison since 1990. And then we compared that to the Milwaukee County African American population and discovered that over half of the young men in their 30s had already served time or were currently serving time. That the state was spending $500,000 a day to incarcerate African American men from Milwaukee County. It's the worst research I've ever done. And I'm so grateful to WWM for turning it over and bringing it forward. Well, so, but I have my one.
I was just going to ask, so where would you start? What would be the one thing that you would do to start this?
Yes, I've got the one thing. This is, when that reporter, Franz, came, he said, I'd never been to Wisconsin. He was doing a series around the country on altered states, looking at demographics and how things had changed. So I said, what's interesting about Wisconsin? And, of course, what he found interesting was that we were locking up half, in the state, half of our young African-American men. Broke my heart. So what I want to say is my solution is not to fix the inner city, but to fix the outer city. We talk seriously about spending $1 billion in taxpayer money for a new Bradley Center, a new auditorium, and new recreational facilities. We talk seriously about spending a fortune building a double-decker freeway to Waukesha. We live in an alternative universe. We think the most precious assets we have are those things we build that we spend so much money for, when the most valuable things we have are our people. And until we invest in our people, call it a Marshall Plan, I don't care what, but we start putting them first and saying jobs for people and opportunities for people and second chances for people and fixing ourselves too, I think that's what we have to do. But I don't want to lose this opportunity because I believe that every one of us, as we try to make the big changes, have to say, but I'm going to do something right now. Right now, I'm going to help somebody or make some change. So the change I want to make right now is put free driver's education back in the high schools. So that every Milwaukee kid learns how to legally drive, so the police department don't have to spend their time tracking down lousy drivers who don't have driver's licenses. Teach those kids to drive. It's an employment competency, and we'll all be better off for it. And it won't cost anything like a stadium or a...
Well, before we get to audience questions, State Representative Rob Hutton, you are a politician from the suburbs and in the majority party in the state legislature. So let me ask you this: the budget cycle is coming up. Can we afford to be locking up so many people in Milwaukee and statewide? I mean, where does the cost of mass incarceration come in as we talk about solutions?
Well, I think that's one of the beauties of this topic, as difficult as this topic is there is a tremendous amount of bipartisan support for this discussion. because this discussion just isn't a fiscal discussion. It's not just about spending $1 billion a year, albeit that is a tremendous concern. It's also the moral capital issue and the human capital issue that Lois actually talked about as well. And so because there are so many facets to this issue, there is a broad scope of support amongst the legislature to figure out what does this mean going forward and what does it mean from a fiscal perspective when we continue to increase our House of Corrections budget by 4 to 6% every year, that we continue to put brick and mortar into our corrections facilities, that we're comfortable continuing to incarcerate more and more individuals, combined with the fact that our city continues to be impacted so dramatically because we have these broken families, we have these missed opportunities for skilled workforce, we've missed opportunities to provide serious reform for those individuals that have in fact served their time, that are now getting back into those communities. So as we've talked about this as a legislative body, and Senator Harris and Representative Cuenca and Representative Goyke and others who have begun to look into this issue, we're finding a lot of common concern and, quite frankly, common solutions to this issue that will be, I think, paramount not only to the budget, but as we go into the summer and we have a couple of committees that are specifically going to look at this topic, my being one, where we're going to look at the sentencing that we've been traditionally applying to minor felonies and misdemeanors and saying, historically, why have we done it? What has been the result? And is that the right path going forward? And are there better ways to address those levels of criminal activity that doesn't include putting them behind bars?
Well, so do we have questions from the audience at this point? There is, wow, we have a lot of questions. And please meet our, Bonnie North is down in front in the yellow T-shirt.
Do we have, there it is. Okay, just want to make tests. If everyone can come, I have kind of a bum knee, so if I can ask people to come close, and I will come around as much as I can. And Mitch is timing. He's got the bell. So everybody's got about 30 seconds, please.
So, yeah, we'd like you to keep your questions focused on solutions and as close to 30 seconds or less as possible, and that will cut you off.
And that will do it. And let me hold the mic, please.
Hi, I'm Ms. Lampkins. I work in the school system, and my question is very simple. We have a lot of law enforcement starting very early, especially with boys with disorderly conduct tickets and all sorts of other things, things that were handled in an old school fashion by just an administration. And a lot of times police come to school, you know, start the profiling of students even before the parents are called. And I feel like they're being tracked very early at the school with a lot of law enforcement with this manner versus being tracked vigorously for mentoring afterwards. How do we solve it?
Thank you for that question. And this would actually be an excellent question for Chief Flynn, who is on the second panel, but I don't know if there's someone on the stage right now who might want to take a crack at it.
Well, most definitely, the situation with children starts at home. So there has to be a sense of value placed at home with these kids. So when they take that to school, they know that they have value and they can call these ill wills to their attitude out. And we can check this thing at the door. So this starts at home. And, you know, we need to bring that to the school, and parents need to be more involved with their children when it comes to these situations. So this needs to be a holistic issue. If the value of worth can be set at home, and that worth can be brought to the school system, we wouldn't have to worry about police profiling our children because we would check it at the door.
All right. Thank you. Let's take another question.
Yes, my name is David Fields. I've been charged with being a state coordinator and organizer for Wisdom St. Vincent de Paul and CCHD for the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. I actually made a call to Representative Kayinga and Representative Hutton, so hopefully we can meet to discuss this further. The DOC, the probation and parole, the pardons, nothing is going on in our administration. They're not being held accountable. Who can hold them accountable? How can we get the guys out of prison? They're not being given parole and just being told you haven't served long enough.
Let's ask our two lawmakers to respond. Where does reform within the Department of Corrections come in?
I think that's an excellent question. And in fact, on tomorrow, I do have a meeting with some folks in my office that do represent MICA, as well as State Secretary Anderson, where we will address that particular question and try to figure out what can we do to make sure that people who have served their time can actually get out in a timely manner, especially if they are in a minimum security prison. We want to certainly make sure that they have all the tools that they need to be able to get back into society and be productive in our communities and get jobs. So that's a real question that I am trying to address right now, and the conversation is starting. So there's lots that we can do. We know that we have a problem with probation and parole officer, well, probation and parole policies in general, and something needs to happen with it, and it needs to be addressed quickly. So it is something I'm working on.
Representative Hutton.
Sure, and again, great question. Some of the things that we're still learning about this issue, and to that point, we've set up a meeting next week with the Department of Corrections to talk specifically about our parole process, both prior to 2000 and post-2000, to make sure we understand what's happening and why it's happening and if some things need to change there.
We're glad to hear that. By the way, we did invite a representative from the Department of Corrections to come here tonight, and they did not respond. They did not respond. But we do have Michael Hafman from the House of Correction, so we can get the information he can bring us. Let's see who has the next question, please.
Hi, my name is Barbara Robinson, and I'm speaking because I have a question, and we all can say what can be done and what's going to be done when nothing is done. Representative Hutton, I heard what you said. I want to believe that we are here in a racist state, that the government, our governor, has promised things, and I recorded his speech when he was campaigning. The only thing that I see he's held true to is that his promise to keep an inmate in prison as long as they could without releasing them. That is the only thing. I am a mother. I'm a 23-year vet from the military. I'm a 17-year retired police officer for the city of Milwaukee, and I do have sons that are incarcerated for a first-time offense sentenced to over 100 years. The article was in Sunday's paper. I am angry. I am hurt. But on top of that, I'm faithful, and I'm not hateful. I don't seek revenge. I'm looking for justice, and I want to know what's going to be done.
Let me perhaps frame this in a straightforward way. Is it too much to ask that things will change in an election year?
Yeah, I would love to say that elections don't have a lot to do with policy. All we can do is speak for ourselves as elected officials, and you all can gauge our behavior from there. In terms of this being election year, I know there are duties to campaign, and I will say there are those of us that are taking more time involved in committees and addressing these type of issues than we are campaigning, because to me this dovetails right into the next term, and hopefully we'll build some momentum from there.
We should also make reference to the fact that we invited Governor Walker to be a part of our panel tonight, and he cited a scheduling conflict. Let's take another question from the audience.
Yes, my name is Dee Dee Connolly, and I'm here because I would like to know, why do the parole and probation people have so much power and control, and they're even disrespectful to family? And I have a son that's incarcerated, and my son did get out and go through programs. I have papers here where he completed truck driving school. My son was working at a construction job when they put him back in prison. I mean, it's just awful. What do you do? Who do you go to? And we hear all this talk, but who do we really go to for help? This is awful.
I think some of the people on the panel might be able to give her an answer. Where do you go when you get out of prison and you want to work, and something happens, and they come for you again?
Again, you guys have great questions. I think that they are just the questions that need to be asked. And the problem with our laws right now is we are serving under a truth in sentencing policy where it totally gives probation officers more control than they need to have with parole, people who are being re-entry into society. And so that is another issue that seriously needs to be addressed, and that is an issue that myself and Representative Goyke is currently working on to make sure that we revise those policies, that we take that power away from probation officers because they don't deserve that power. The power should be up to the families and the people who are coming back and programs, treatment like treatment and diversion. We have programs like Word of Hope Ministries. We have wisdom programs. We have programs where we can get these people back on track so they can have a better life, and they should not be treated like criminals as if they, you know, they serve their time. It's time to go back into society, and we need to hold them accountable as well as the people who are working with them.
Nathan Holton, you look like you have something to add.
I can't speak for state policy, but I can speak locally. We have a program that we've just rolled out in the last couple of months on dosage probation, and what that means is that when someone is on probation, instead of just being on paper for 5 years, regardless of what you do, what you do is you have this evidence-based program that you go through. It says that according to a risk assessment, you should have this programming, that programming, job programming, etc. And once you complete all of that programming to the satisfaction of the program, you get out, even if it's before the five-year period. It's a pilot project. We're just starting it now. We're going to see if it works. But that's one thing that's happening locally to address that situation.
Let's take our next question from the audience.
Can I please just say one more thing? Not only are our black men being incarcerated, but they're also being character assassinated. Their characters also are being assassinated. So that's hard for them, too, to get ahead.
Yeah, can I want to comment on the second chance idea. I mean, I'm glad the religious community is so involved with this issue. And we simply have to reach a point where we forgive people, where we actually give them a second chance, where you finish. And the CCAP system, where we put charges and crimes out for the rest of people's lives, is, in my judgment, terribly destructive. We have to start separating. No freedom is absolute. We have to start separating what kinds of things we can do. I mean, we drew, you know, we picked three things. We said, what are the big, what's the big picture here? Public safety. Our children have to be safe. They have to live in communities where they can play, where they're protected. We put the police out there, and we say, no matter how outrageous our policies are, you keep us all safe. It's a huge task. It's not enough. We should strengthen families, and we should support employment. And I think at every phase, including extended supervision, and then once people are released, we say, are we supporting those things? Or are we just creating a climate where people will reoffend? Because then we don't get any of it.
Next question, please.
Hi. I just noticed the, 24.5% unemployment rate among black males or the black population in the inner city. That's atrocious. Can you imagine if the entire state had that rate of unemployment? What a clamor, what a public clamor there would be for the powers that be to actually do something about that, maybe akin to what Roosevelt did in terms of a civilian conservation corps, something to provide opportunity for people who seem to have no doors open to them. I also want to give a shout out to the Mary Ryan Boys and Girls Club that does an amazing job in this city. I wish it could be replicated 1,000 times over. Thank you.
I don't know if anybody wants to take that, the issue, at least the issue of employment.
Well, the issue of unemployment is horrific. I mean, I think it's larger than 24%. I think it's over half black men who are unemployed, who can't support their families. I mean, and the job situation is so dire here that, you know, you have employers turning their back on this population. So who do you run to when this happens? You know, you run to the government agencies. You come together as a people and hold DOC accountable. We need people collectively to come together to hold these people accountable. And businesses need to step up to the plate and honor these men who have the qualifications for the jobs instead of Xing them out because of the stigma of being an ex-offender. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, we really, it needs to be a concentrated effort on the African-American skill set and the African-American employment rate. It has to be a concentrated effort.
Before we take the next question, let me just make the observation. We have a very long line of questions. We only have a few more minutes in this half of the panel, but we'll take a break near the top of the hour for about 5 minutes and come back. We'll seat our second panel. We'll get some more questions from the audience as quickly as possible. So if we don't get to your question during this half, please be assured that that we'll continue to take questions in the second half of the program.
Brenda Bell-White, I don't have a question, but I do have some suggestions. Racism, number one factor. Laws that incarcerate and laws that keep those who have been incarcerated unemployed. They've got to change. Policing, I don't care what Chief Lynn says. A traffic stop program is AKA racial profiling. If I have not done anything, do not stop me. And it's poor policing. Sentencing, over-sentencing and enhanced sentencing, as you mentioned, Senator Harris. Corrections is a problem. I spent 12 years there as a manager. Revocations is unregulated and it's out of control. They revoke people based on behavior. They work with the DA's office because if they don't charge, then we'll revoke. We'll revoke.
So you've brought up a lot of issues, and let's see if we can get a response.
Well, one last thing, okay? We got to stop building prisons, because if we do, we'll fill them. And contrary to what you said, Mr. Brown, we need to stop calling police to the schools, okay?
Thank you.
Yeah, that's big time. Look, I think it's important to note that a lot of progress has been made in the last few years, and I know that this crowd probably doesn't want to hear that right now, but there's some facts that I got to put out here. Number one, the data that we're looking at here in terms of black male incarceration is from 2010. All right, that's 4 years ago.
12.
Okay, 2012. It's from the census, is it not? Okay. So the population, according to your own report, Lois, of black male individuals who have been getting sent to prison has been going down since 2008. And the reason that that has occurred is because there's been an increase in alternatives to incarceration in Milwaukee County. You have more diversions, you have more DPAs, you have a drug court, you have a focus on mental health, you have all these programs that are going on. Admittedly, we do a horrible job of broadcasting that. Our PR is not very good. But there's been a big increase in emphasis in keeping people out of prison, and the results have begun to show themselves in terms of the prison population going down. So that's one thing that needs to be noted here.
Is there enough money for those programs?
No.
Well, there's never enough money to... Look, you can always have more money, of course, but we're doing the best that we can. There's limited control locally over how much money we have for these programs. We're doing what we can with the money that we have.
And Rob Hutton and Nakia Harris, are those programs that are going to be up for more money in the next budget cycle?
Again, what we talked about how much we were spending on incarceration, what the next budget is going to look like. And I think it is very important to mention that we've taken money from universities, from two-year colleges, in order to support incarceration and support the work that's happening in incarceration. We need to take that money back out and put it into these programs, and then we will have enough money to cover the programs. But we still need more, but I think that we can do much more work if we can start to look at how that pie is divided and dividing it in the right way and putting the money where it needs to go, and that is treatment and diversion. That is putting it into universities and two-year colleges so that people can get the training that they need.
Rob Hutton, is it as easy as that?
Sure, and we've added, just in the last biennium budget, $1 million a year alone for the TAD program. So we understand that those investments are necessary. There's a great return on those investments because they are effective, and we'll continue to look at funding for those going forward.
Right. I think one of the really promising things that happened a couple of weeks ago, Mayor Barrett announced that he would hire 25 ex-offenders, specifically said ex-offenders, to fill potholes. And 550 people called about the jobs. And we know that if you will, I mean, at least he finally openly said, we're looking for ex-offenders. And the WIDA immediately afterwards said, okay, they would look for ex-offenders too. We know that if we put transitional jobs out there,
that literally hundreds and probably thousands of people will come forward and say, I want one, I will work. And we can start there. And those kinds of programs should be funded to the utmost.
Now, this will be the last question for this session, but as Mitch said,
you are welcome.
We have another session after this. We're not ending now. We have another hour after this. But let me remind everybody, make your question and comment short.
And you are welcome to stay in the aisle during the break.
Yes. So, last question for this hour.
Wow.
Teresa Thomas Boyd, statement and question. One is, I want to know, how do we really deal with racism? That's one of the elephants that stays in the room that we never really deal with. The prison population and a lot of things in the state of Wisconsin comes from the racism. When you even deal with the children mortality issues, a lot of things come from inner racism and stress that's caused in our communities. My questions are, one, how do we begin to prevent? I don't want to just see people go to jail. How do we deal with our children at an early age so that we can help them in our schools? Suspension is ridiculous in our schools. It leads children to go into the communities and do dumb stuff because they don't have anywhere to go if there's nobody at home. So my suggestion and ways is to deal with racism and to deal with our children earlier. Education needs to be made a number one. Thank you.
Andre Brown.
Let's look at Wisconsin. Wisconsin is the mother load of segregation. I mean, Milwaukee is the most segregated city in the nation. So it's time to have a race relations talk. It's time. And hopefully Wisconsin will be the precedent for the rest of the nation. The problem is people in the northern Milwaukee get bad media about southern Wisconsin. That's the problem. The media promotes the negative of African Americans. You don't hear the positive of African Americans, like Project Return, like programs that go in the neighborhood, like the culture of the neighborhood. You don't hear about that. All you hear is little nut-nut getting locked up. That's all you hear. So it's time for race relation, especially in this city, because we're too segregated. So that's the first part. Now, the second part for our children, I will go back. It all starts at home. We need parents to step up and start parenting again. Now, this is becoming such an issue now that parents are so ill-regarded to their children that now the foster care system is becoming baby jail. So we need to focus on parenting and race relations, and we can move forward.
Well, this is going to conclude our first panel, the first half of our town hall forum. We have another hour coming up. First of all, we want to thank everybody who's here. We want to thank Lois Quinn, Andre Brown, State Representative Rob Hutton, State Senator Nikia Harris, Michael Haifman,
and Nathan Holton.
Nathan Holton down at the end. I can't quite see his name, son. But we want to thank them all for coming and being here today.
And we should mention that most, if not all, of the panelists are sticking around. There is a session. We have another hour after the second half, where hopefully if you have questions for specific panelists, you can chat with them informally as well. But now let's take a break to let you stretch your legs and use the restroom and allow our next panel to take the stage. The second half of the town hall will begin in about 5 minutes.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Well, welcome back for the second half of our town hall forum on finding ways to lower the rate of incarceration among African-American men in our community. I'm Mitch Tyke from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
And I'm Joanne Williams of Milwaukee Public Television. We have a 5-member panel for this session to take on the issues we've been discussing and maybe some new ones in this hour. Let's meet them now.
Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn has held his position since January of 2008. He tells us he's looking forward to a discussion that defines the complex social truths that result in the racial disparity in both incarceration and crime victimization.
Minister William Harrell is the co-founder of Table of the Saints. The prison ministry offers former inmates help with housing, job training, and other services. He is a former inmate himself. He obtained his ministry credentials while he was incarcerated.
Clarence Johnson is Associate Director of Wisconsin Community Services, which runs more than 40 programs, including residential reentry services such as halfway houses. Johnson's responsibilities include oversight of workforce development for people in the criminal justice system.
Brian Murphy is with the Milwaukee Area Workforce Investment Board. It's a partnership between government and business that coordinates employment and training programs. Murphy is program monitor for Focused on My Future. It's a reentry program for individuals who are 18 to 21 years old.
And David Pate is associate professor in UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare and a faculty affiliate of UW-Madison's Institute for Research on Poverty. He co-founded the Center for Family Policy and Practice, which works to remove barriers that affect low-income men of color. Pate takes part in regular conversations about race, gender, and class on WUWM's Lake Effect program.
Now, as we did with the panel during the first half of the program, we're going to start by asking each of the panelists to respond in about 1 minute and address the single most important solution you believe will make a difference in helping solve the problem of this high rate of incarceration among black men in our community. Let's begin with Chief Flynn.
Well, thank you for inviting me to this panel, and we're grateful to the authors of the study that brings to light a serious societal problem. And the good thing about identifying a problem is it results in discussion and ultimately results in an analysis that leads to responses that may, in fact, have an impact. So putting this issue front and center, I think, is a real public service. From the point of view of the police department, the single thing we need to do to reduce the levels of incarceration is to reduce the levels of victimization in our most disadvantaged neighborhoods. We took a look at our data in the 6 zip codes that were identified as producing the most individuals who are incarcerated. And we found that those 6 zip codes represent just 26% of the city's population, but 44% of its crime victims. Those 6 zip codes result in 63% of our homicide victims live in those zip codes. 67% of our victims of non-fatal shootings come from that 26% of the population. 55% of our victims of aggravated assaults, 53% of our robbery victims come from the same zip codes the offenders come from. And I think our challenge is to recognize that violent crime destroys opportunities and destroys the opportunities for neighborhoods to cohere and exert the informal social control that many of us in our neighborhoods take for granted. Violent crime prevents the formations of strong communities, and violent crime drives out economic opportunity. Neighborhoods with reputations for violence do not generate jobs. And when cars are stolen in those neighborhoods, and that's where half of our car thefts come from, by the way, jobs are stolen as well, because as was shown on the film we saw before, people without transportation, absent mass transit, can't get to work. So the challenge for us is to reduce crime while at the same time trying to build neighborhood capacity. And that's why we're committed to a community-based, problem-oriented, and yes, data-driven strategy. Because the crime victims in those neighborhoods demand that the police reduce the levels of violence and reduce the disparate victimization of those communities. Now, we're pledged to do so. We want to do it in a fair and equitable manner, and we're transparent in doing it. And we recognize that there will be issues going forward, but the number one thing we need is community trust and community support in those efforts. And we spend a great deal of time in those neighborhoods trying to develop just that. But the unfortunate fact result remains that when we do the community's will in our highest crime neighborhoods, we are going to generate disparities in arrests compared to the general population that match the disparities in victimization compared to the general population. And the fact remains those neighborhoods are the most devastated by crime in the entire city.
Let's move down to Brian Murphy and see if he has a one solution.
Well, my experience comes from working with individuals that have come out of juvenile corrections and that are between the ages of 18 and 21. And one of the things that, or a lot of the things that I see are these individuals are very talented, but they have very low math and reading grade levels. And they're building prisons based off of low math and reading grade levels as early as the third grade. So one of the things that I think that they need are more funding for supportive services programs as early as first grade, because these our students are falling behind. And when they fall behind, that affects their self-esteem. And also, it causes disruptive behavior in classrooms, and it disrupts learning, and they're labeled. So a lot of these services need to go in helping these individuals and helping our children to increase these math and reading grade levels. And also, again, it's a holistic approach. Definitely what goes on at home can definitely be an effect on that, like what was stated earlier in terms of the single families. We have a ton of single family households with no male presence. A lot of our young black males have an unhealthy idea and belief of what malehood should look like. And, you know, they have poor examples, and they're also passing those poor examples and beliefs to younger children. So it's a cyclical situation. So definitely what goes on at home in education.
Brian Murphy, thanks. Let's jump to this side of the table, and we'll try to keep it as close to the 1 to 2 minutes as possible. David Pate.
Thank you, Mitch. I think instead of answering the question, I'm going to rephrase it. I think that it's clear that Wisconsin and its citizens create and choose policies and practices that send far too many people, particularly black people, to jail. But I would ask the question, what can Wisconsin citizens do to reduce the high rate at which we send black people to jail and prison? One being that we drastically reduce the number of people that police in Wisconsin arrest, including people of all races and ethnicities, but especially black people. I think although it's not the only way for a person to become entangled by this life-destroying effects of the criminal justice system, getting arrested by the police is perhaps the most common starting point. And Wisconsin law enforcement agencies have a terrible record of arresting far too many people, particularly black people. If you were to look at this statewide, additionally, law enforcement arrests, I guess, they generally arrest people, many more of all races and ethnicities than that national average. Again, we arrest more people of all ethnicity and races than the national average. However, black people in Wisconsin are nearly three times are likely to be arrested than in the nation as a whole. We also arrest white people more often as well, but only at a rate that is 1.5 times larger than the national average. I think that in short, law enforcement arrests more people in general than the national average, but police officers in Wisconsin are extremely more likely to arrest black people. I think we also need to talk more about alternatives. We often hear about alternatives to incarceration. I think it's time to start talking about alternatives to arrest and alternatives to police contact. This 1 minute is not good for me. What would that look like, giving people tickets for less serious criminal behavior instead of arresting them? Giving people warnings for behaviors that's based on police discretion may or may not rise to the level of criminal conduct, but creating community-based conflict resolution services and programs as an alternative to police involvement. In other words, leave the police out of the situation in the first place.
I suspect these are issues that the chief of police will have the chief of police address as the evening goes on. However, let's continue with the format and have Clarence Johnson.
Well, thank you for inviting me here this evening as well. It's a very difficult question to answer, and I guess let me start off by putting it into a context that if you listen and read too much media information, begin to believe that black men are inherently bad and bound for prison. Well, that's not true. I'm a black man. I wasn't bound for prison. I'm sitting next to David and others down here. So let's get rid of that notion. I think that is a major, major problem. And I want to go back to, and I'll get to the one solution in a moment. I want to go back to something that Nate said a while ago, and also Lois, which is that if we continue to try to fix people once they get into prison, we will never win this. It is not a winnable battle. We have to go back to those things that determine how your life proceeds, and we know what those things are. We control those things. It's education, okay? Stop taking money out of Milwaukee Public School System. It's health care. It's jobs, it's housing, it's all those things that create hope and opportunity and vibrancy in the community. And we have taken, as Chief Lynn has suggested, those six zip codes, and we've extracted all those hopeful factors. Well, when you do that, what do you think is going to happen? So we need to put those things back in the community and stop the, a good friend of mine, Victor Barnett from Running Rebels, uses this phrase, pipeline to prison. We have created that over the past 30 years, and we as a community have to dismantle that. If I were to offer one solution, it would be this, and I may not get the language right. There's such a thing called the Justice Reinvestment Act, and some states have done this, which means that you take money that you're currently using to maintain prisons in Wisconsin, over $1 billion, you reinvest some of that money back into those six zip codes you talked about, Chief Flynn. You create jobs, you improve education, health care, you create safe neighborhoods. Let's reinvest the money. That's my one solution.
Minister Harrell, do you have one solution?
Yes, I do have.
And I think if you could pull the microphone a little closer to you, that'd be great.
Yes, I do have a solution. Prison prevention. Oh, well, first I'd like to thank UWM for this panel, and also Joanne and Mitch for thank you. School to prison pipeline. That's really a problem, and I'm with a group called the Table of the Saints, and what we do is we go into these schools and we talk to the kids. And we show these children the path that we went down and how they can turn their lives around. They don't have to do the same mistakes that we did. Case in point, as I went to pick up my grandson from school, I saw a problem that was fueling our nation's prison system at epidemic proportions. Little black boy sitting outside of the principal's office. Far too often, students of color have been targeted for the school-to-prison pipeline. These children already suffer with a history of abuse, neglect, poverty, and learning disabilities. Okay, let's compare the facts and the stats. A 2007 study by the Advancement Project and the Power Youth Center for Social Change says that out of every 100 students who were suspended, 15 were black, 7.9 were American Indian, 6.8 were Latino, and 4.8 were white. So do we see the disparity here? You know, proverb, I'd like to bring up a proverb, and it's about the sower, the seed sower. When seed sowers plant, they expect fruit. Thoughts are seeds planted in the garden of the mind. Positive thoughts produce good fruits. Negative thoughts produce bad fruits. When our black children are collectively being pushed into prison, the result of that is the color of mass incarceration. It cannot help but be black. I'd like to go in the faith-based arena. I'm with a group called MICA, Table of the Saints, and the Company of Good Men. And we strive to help these people in prison. I mean, we have a 22,000 prison population in Wisconsin, 22,000. And our goal is to cut it to 11,000 by 2015. It seems like a tall order. But with the help of everybody in this arena, we can get this problem solved.
Let's turn now to, thank you very much, Minister. Thank you very much. Let's turn to the folks who are waiting, who have been waiting patiently to ask their questions and make your comments. And I hope we get some solutions. What's your one solution?
Well, I have a couple of quick things that I'm going to run through, and I'm going to do it very quickly. First of all, House Correction, when somebody gets Huber and is allowed to keep their job, which is often their lifeline, there's no transportation provided for those people to get into the city of Milwaukee to get to their jobs. My former son-in-law was not able to be on Huber because he had nobody to pick him up every single morning and drop him off every single night, and I dare say most people incarcerated won't have that. So that is something that is physically blocking people, and there's no reason for it. It's complete stupidity to me. Also, I raised two biracial children in the inner city. I was raised myself in the suburbs, and when my daughter had an intruder at her door, breaking in her door, she called the police. She did what anybody would do. The police showed up 2 hours later when we were upset that they had taken so long because I had to go over and protect my daughter with a baseball bat. We were told in my neighborhood, which is one of those zip code areas, that, oh, in this neighborhood, when somebody's trying to break in, it's usually over drugs anyway. Now, how are we who live in those neighborhoods supposed to feel about calling the police? Then, when my daughter got upset that they said that, they threatened to arrest her, my biracial daughter. So those are my points. We could easily get transportation for these people to keep their jobs. And when you let somebody out of the county jail, give them 50 cents to make a phone call. You let them out at midnight, they're walking the streets of downtown, no phone, not a dime, because even if they had money when they came in, they can't get it out at midnight.
All right. Well, let's... I don't know if anybody on the panel wants to speak to the issue of transportation. David Pate, is that something that that you're comfortable with?
Transportation is a problem. I agree totally. I know that with a lot of the men that I interview in my work in Milwaukee, I've been interviewing men in Milwaukee for the last 18 years, and the major issue for them is that they cannot get to and from their jobs because we do not have an infrastructure that allows for people to be able to work and not be harassed. I know that I've said in the past this to Chief Flynn, and in my own work as a researcher, I often get stopped by the police when I'm going into neighborhoods that are those zip codes because they think I'm a drug dealer. So I often am able to empathize with what they are saying because I know from my own experience it's a real issue that they can't. It's almost if we, and I don't want to take much more time, but the one thing I have found is that we don't see that men can be victims of trauma. We don't see that families who are poor and that poverty is a real public health issue that causes the violence. If people have resources, they're not going to do that. I mean, there's research that proves it. There's solid research that shows poverty is a real problem that leads to depression and other acts of violence. And it's not because they are less than. It's often an issue of the infrastructure and the structural constraints of a society that doesn't work.
Chief Flynn, this is probably not the only comment that will address the issue of racial profiling. How do you take on the issues that you say you need to take on in zip codes like the six that come up time and again without doing it in a way that appears as though it's racial profiling?
Well, we have to understand that, you know, proper police tactics, when you're exposed to them, can be experienced as alienating and frightening. So a big part of what we try to do is stay connected to the neighborhood-based community groups to explain what we're doing. The other thing is we monitor the data, because I want to make sure that the car stops in a given policing district pretty much line up with the amount of crime in that district. And so we look at this constantly, because we're aware that no police tactic can be supported for long if people believe that it's being differentially applied. So, you know, I've got...
Please let him respond, though.
Let him finish, please. Let him finish.
So at any rate, every year and every few months, we look at the data and try to line it up. For all of 2013, for example, you know, District 2, which is Southside, had 13% of our violent crime and 16% of our car stops. District 3, which is Northside, had 15% of our violent crime and 13% of our car stops. District 4, 14% of the crime, 13% of the car stops. District 5, 15% of the crime and 16% of the car stops. And so the challenge we have is to try to match our proactive approaches to the levels of violence in different neighborhoods. And I've said this in other venues as well. I'll say it probably several times tonight. There's no getting around the fact that the disparity in victimization is one of the great problems of our disadvantaged neighborhoods. They are the places where people are being murdered. They are the places where people are being robbed. And it's their neighborhood cohesion that is broken by fear of violence. Now, we all know that there are many variables that have produced a circumstance in which the neighborhoods that have the highest rate of unemployment and the highest rate of poverty and the lowest high school graduation rates and the most abandoned houses and the most fires are the ones where there's the most violent crime. But when the people in those neighborhoods dial 911, they expect us to do something about it. They expect us to work to prevent it. And the tools at our disposal are not magic. It's ascertain where the crime is, try to learn who the chronic offenders are, and put your people there to do something. The communities demand that. Now, those folks might not be here tonight, or there might be, but they demand that we, their public officials, protect them. And last year, 85 of our 106 homicides were African-American males. Their parents want us to stop that. They want us to arrest the people that did it. They want us to take the guns out of the hands of the people that are shooting them. 500 shootings last year, 100 homicides last year, and more than three-quarters of them were in our afflicted communities. 2,000 firearms recovered last year, the vast majority in those same communities. Now, I'm not blaming people for the circumstances that have put them in this location, but we're the ones, next Saturday, the people are going to demand we do something about next Saturday's shootings, just like last Saturday. Nobody stuck a microphone in our faces last week and said, stop trying to be proactive. No, they said, we had five shootings on Saturday. What are you doing about it? And those shootings are occurring in places that already have got two strikes against them. Those neighborhoods are in jeopardy for a whole variety of circumstances, but one of them is losing their young men to deadly violence. Now, I'm not trying to say prison is the only answer. I'm not trying to gainsay the results of this study, that we don't have an issue in our hands that requires serious thought. But every complicated problem has got a simple answer that's usually wrong. This is a network of problems. We are part of the social response. But even in these highest crime neighborhoods, 80% of our work is still social work. People are calling us for everything because there's nobody else. The social net has huge holes in it. And right now, the only people lining up on Milwaukee's side are the people who live in Milwaukee. So we've got each other, and we have to work together to do something about it.
I will note that there are actually a lot of people lining up right here. So let us take the next question. Chief Flynn, thank you very much.
My name is Jafar Banda. I'm the president of Community Uprise, which is a student organization with UW-Milwaukee. Our focus is the mass incarceration and to focus on trying to reinstate the Partner Advisory Board. Now, what I want to talk about is how we are experiencing an overwhelming amount of wasted potential, and we need to look into giving people another chance. Our governor, well, former Governor Thompson, when he wanted to be president, he looked into citizenship restoration through the Partner Advisory Board. Now, our Governor Walker, he wants the national spotlight, and he has not yet responded to mass incarceration. I don't see how he plans on becoming the president and leading our state in the mass incarceration. So what we need to do is we need to get more politicians to care about Milwaukee. Governor Walker is not only ignoring the Partner Advisory Board, he's forgetting about the poverty in Milwaukee and the unemployment rate. And we also experiencing a lot of racial profiling that needs to be in the backseat of our Milwaukee Police Department. So we need more of a racial balance system of Milwaukee police officers. And I would like to, for the Chief Flynn to especially address that.
Well, Chief Flynn, the racial balance of the police department as a potential solution. And then I'm curious to get Brian Murphy's take on the workforce area in terms of bringing down the unemployment rate.
Well, the police department right now probably is more diverse at the senior ranks than it's ever been. And a lot of our officers that were recruited in the 80s and 90s have risen to the highest levels of the department. We've got a diverse class in the academy right now, but it's not as diverse as I'd like it. And it's one area where we really need more community support and assistance. You know, I don't pretend that we get it right all the time. I don't pretend that we're universally loved all the time. But I'm also proud of the fact that every day the men and women in this department are serving and protecting every resident of this city. And what we need is community support in encouraging young people to join our ranks. By all means, criticize us. By all means, demand better performance. But I was raised in a generation that said you're either part of the solution or part of the problem. And one way to be part of the solution is to get into police work and protect your community with us. Rise through the ranks. Affect our policy. Be that perspective that you may think we're lacking now. But our officers out there are working very hard to protect every single community at great personal risk. And we would like young men and women of every racial and ethnic background to see policing as the worthy, noble work that it truly is. People depend on us. Communities depend upon us. And we need communities to help us recruit their best and their brightest.
Brian Murphy or Clarence Johnson, would one of you like to talk about job training?
I can certainly start, and happy to pass it over to Brian. As was indicated earlier, Wisconsin Community Services is heavily involved in training, job training, and preparation of people who are involved in the criminal justice system to get back into meaningful work. We work very closely with Brian, his colleagues, with the Department of Correction. We have good programs. As was noted earlier, we don't have enough programs. My personal opinion is that we don't have a coordinated strategy to address this issue. We don't have, I don't know how many folks are here this evening from corporate Milwaukee, corporate Metro Milwaukee. We need more involvement from those folks. WCS has recently launched an alternative staffing organization, which essentially is a temp to perm placement entity for folks who are marginalized, which includes those folks in the criminal justice system. And we talk about man the box, all those kinds of things, but the reality for us is that we need a more coordinated strategy. We do need more resources. We need to have resources that are holistic, because when a person comes to us for work, they have a myriad, and Brian knows this, of other kinds of issues, whether it's mental health issues, addiction issues, shelter, trauma that they've experienced, and the time frame that we have to work with them is not long enough. I was out in San Francisco last year on vacation, and I visited a place called the Delancey Street Foundation. Anybody been there? The average length of stay from folks returning from prison in that facility is about 3 years. They're serious about this. They recognize it's not going to happen in 3, 4, 5, 6 months. It is a sustained effort. It is an integrated effort. You have to address lots of issues, and I'm afraid that the programs that we have, while they are good, probably don't go as far as they need to.
Definitely, and already in Milwaukee, the unemployment rate is very dismal, so that definitely has an effect on our training programs, because obviously, as Clarence said, you know, we have a variety of different training programs, and individuals sometimes lose hope in that when they complete different training programs and there are no jobs at the end of the tunnel. So employer buy-in is definitely important. We work really hard on meeting with employers face-to-face and working with them to work with our clients. And again, it's definitely difficult. And just like, again, what Clarence said in terms of the time period that we have to work with these individuals, it's like just putting a Band-Aid on the problem. You know, some of the individuals that come into our programs and come into our doors, they have a lifetime worth of trauma and all these different experiences and all this different anger and frustration, and to try to change their perception on themselves and change their perception on their future is difficult to do in a 6-month span. So we try to intensify as many services as we can. And again, it's all based on funding as well. So that's definitely been an issue for us.
Well, thank you for explaining what you're doing there. Let's move on to another question.
Hello, my name is Bobby Stawinski. I just did 2 years in a Chippewa Correctional Facility for possession of THC. I was ordered to take a substance abuse program. As a general statement, a lot of what the public is not hearing that is you have a lot of black males that are taking this program. They don't understand it educationally. So they get kicked out of this program just to be asked to take it again 2 weeks later. But in turn of doing so, this same money that's being given to the Division of Corrections for these programs, they're getting it more than once. So I guess, you know, who do you speak to try to help these guys finish this program instead of kicking them out? Now here's another 6 or 10 months they are away from their family when they were granted this through the judicial system.
I don't know if we have the ideal panelists to answer that, but does somebody want to take a crack at it?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that we don't have anyone here from DOC to address that. And you're absolutely right. Oftentimes, those programs they're not available when they're needed. And we work with DOC and also with MyWIB. It's called a Windows to Work program. And so we reach into the prison, state prisons, literally about 6 months before a person is coming out, and we try and get them prepared to return by offering cognitive behavioral programming, job readiness, those kinds of things. And all I can tell you again is that the kinds of challenges that men who are about to return to their communities face is significant. And I'm afraid that the efforts that oftentimes we toss at those challenges is just not enough. And without getting into a lot of detail, we recently launched a program called Community Building Milwaukee, which is basically designed to address issues of trauma and grief that a lot of men and women face, which is oftentimes a catalyst for their going to prison in the first place. And until you can address some of those emotional issues, some of the trauma, some of the grief, you can have the best programs in the world, but if you're not ready to engage in those, if you haven't dealt with those deep-seated issues, you're not going to be successful. And I think we have to take a closer look at those kinds of things.
I think we're going to closely enforce the one-minute rule here just so we can get to as many of these questions as we can.
I think it's because you saw me preparing my question there. You're gonna... All right, but Minister, I want to thank you for your words of wisdom. Indeed, these issues do run deep. You know, Matthew 25, Christ tells those entering heaven, you took care of people in prison, you took care of me, and certainly this it's an issue to think about. Chief, I want to ask you directly because I feel like you are the person here who has the most authority on the panel and the most power to do something. Given that you could have been taken before a court and charged with a Class 1 felony under Wisconsin Statute 944, and let me just say I thank you for being here and for being willing to man up to that occurrence. I'm wondering, would you be willing to hire people on your police force who had prior criminal records, if the funds were made available, if the legislature passed a law and said, this is what we want you to do, would you be willing to do that?
One of the things we've been examining of late is our current policy on hiring people with drug records. You know, we recognize the world has changed a little bit in the last few years. And we found that we were losing some candidates as police aides, mainly because they were honest enough to tell us how recently they'd smoked marijuana. I mean, everybody knows you're not supposed to tell us. So at any rate, you know, one of our concerns is that for quite a long time, it had been basically a two-year window. You know, you should have been smart enough to, if you wanted to go into policing, to abstain for at least that long. But our police aides, of course, are the young ones. They're 18 years old. They're maybe 19 years old. So we've recently undertaken to change that because we want to use that program, as it historically was intended, to try to get young people into policing early before they've gotten much older than 18, get them into college part-time, give them some part-time experience with the police department, and then grow them into police officers. And if they're dumb enough to smoke marijuana while they're a police aide, well, we probably don't want to hire them as officers anyway. But having said that, we do have to examine the background, and that's one area that I think is ripe for it.
I think another area that needs to be explored just generally is what are the inhibitions that are legal versus customary to hiring ex-offenders? I mean, is legislation needed, for example, that doesn't allow you to discriminate against them in hiring? I mean, it would depend, obviously, on the offense. Obviously, you don't want child molesters in a daycare center. But I think you get my drift. If people have, quote, paid their debt to society, it seems to me only reasonable that if they are employable and present themselves for a job, that people not be disinclined in hiring them because of something they did some years ago. Now, I don't know, you know, what kind of research needs to support such a position, but I think it's an avenue to explore because reentry is an essential piece here. And sadly, whenever there's a budget crisis, you know, for some years I was the public safety secretary in Massachusetts. Prisons were part of my bailiwick. And I hate to tell you, every time budget years got lean, the price of fuel oil went up in the prisons and the number of programs got cut. That was the easy cut for the legislature. It always is. It's always programming that goes first. Well, we know how essential programming is because they all come home eventually. So if we could put together more effective prison programming, perhaps connected to legislation that prohibited discriminating against people on the basis of a prior record, maybe we could break some of that log jam of post-incarceration employment.
All right.
Well, hang on. Let's let the folks who are in line ask their questions, and we'll get to you as quickly as we can. Thank you.
Yes, my name is Troy Hawkins, and it says on the Black Voices flyer, 1 in 3 black males will go to prison in their lifetime, and you ask, what can we do? I don't have the answer to that. I know that I just spent 8 years on supervision. I got off in December, and I was able to go to California because I didn't have to get traveling permit finally. And what I saw was I was riding the bus on my way to a 12-step meeting. I'm 4 years clean and sober. I was in Delancey Street. It was my first treatment in San Francisco in 1986, and I saw a skateboard park, and I got off, and I talked to the people running it. They said they took 5 years to fight for funding out of the city money to put to the Parks and Recreation Department to build for those young people. So I'm apologizing to these young kids who are here from Milwaukee Academy of Sciences that we have failed you as adults. We have failed you, and I live in that zip code, 53216, 209, 206, and 212. There are no skateboard parks. There's no roller skating rinks. There's no ice skating rinks in the wintertime. There's no bowling alleys. There's no dance halls, and there's no activities for these young people. That's how we're failing them.
I don't know if anybody has anything to add to that.
I'd like to comment on that. We're going back to prison prevention. This is a problem here in Milwaukee. I remember when I was coming up, and this was years ago, I guess I'm going to reveal my age here, back in the 1960s, there were mentoring programs, okay? Even the police, the Milwaukee Police Department had a mentoring program, okay? And they would take the at-risk kids out of school, and they would take them on trips. They would take them and show them various, different way of life, okay? If I can, Joanne Williams' father mentored me, okay? And now we have mentoring programs. We have faith-based mentoring programs. We have the Table of the Saints, as I mentioned earlier. We have Company of Good Men. We have, several faith-based organizations that are trying to step up to the plate for this prison prevention. But we need everybody to step up to the plate, not just the church. The church is where things start. Correctly, but we need society at large to help out in mentoring. I mean, we just looking at these kids and seeing what they're going through. Oh, look at them! They're going in the wrong direction. Well, go and talk to those children. I mean, a word of wisdom, man, goes a long way. Talk to these babies. These are our kids.
Let's take another question.
Angie Trudell Vasquez, and I have not heard this, so I'll bring it up. I think we could solve our mass incarceration problem by ending the drug war, which is a war on the people of color. I think we begin by legalizing marijuana, taxing it similar to cigarettes and alcohol, And I think you can look at Colorado and Washington and see that they're making a lot of money that they can reinvest in education. The drug war has been a war on the people of color. You have men that are separated from their families. You have people that have been caught with possession that are in for a very long time. And that would be a great step. It's not been mentioned. And I think it's something that should be discussed. Thank you.
Well, let me ask Chief Flynn, if law enforcement is basically in a position of enforcing policy that other people enact, do you think the drug war is a policy that's been enacted wrongly?
Well, I think there are a lot of parts of that that need to be examined separately. You know, there's a, you know, in the last couple of years, marijuana arrests in Milwaukee have declined as we've, you know, come to recognize that a lot of our street encounters are basically are resulting in what I'd call unintentional marijuana arrests when the purpose of the street stop is to reduce the violence. So we've reexamined some of our policies to try to cut back on that, and we've had some success, but our heroin arrests are up by 117%. There's no gainsaying the fact that you know, all marijuana users don't go on to heroin. We all know that, but all heroin users started with marijuana. And I think we just need to be very thoughtful when we start opening that particular Pandora's box. We know the social harms of alcohol. They're extraordinary. We know that 10% of the population is heavily addicted to alcohol. Alcohol is involved in a large number of our shootings and violent crimes within the home. We also know an awful lot of our violence is around the drug trade. And so those are tangential issues that are very real. So, as I say, complicated answers tend to suggest simple answers that are wrong. I think this is a problem that really needs to be carefully examined, and I think the experiences in Washington and Colorado bear scrutiny. They're going to require some good PhDs to get out there and analyze the social costs versus the social gains equation over time before we decide to do this nationally.
Let's take another question from our audience. Who's next in line? Please step up.
Hi. I've waited a long time, and some of the issues that I was going to speak about have been spoken about. I'm not going to speak about my opinion on how people get to prison or why. I'm going to talk about conditions in prison. I have a son in prison, and I can tell you that our prisons make people worse. They don't make them better. And I don't understand why it is not obvious that we make people worse in prison. Now, I have one suggestion for one simple thing. It won't necessarily help the black community, but it will help all of us. Wisconsin is one of the very few states that still uses long-term solitary confinement as a correctional measure. We must end this. It is torture. That's all I have.
For the people with experience in prison, does it make you worse? Is it something that doesn't make you better?
Let me tell you, prison is a state of mind. Okay, a lot of us are in prison out here free out in the streets. Okay, so prison, it's not the prison. It's it's the structure of the prison, okay? I was a victim of solitary confinement, okay? I survived 190 days. Wisconsin has, he's correct, Wisconsin has the worst solitary confinement in the nation. And listen, when I was doing my 190, there were guys doing 360. Two men committed suicide. Guys were cutting themselves. Guys were hanging themselves. They were throwing feces at the guards. I mean, these are the mental atrocities that solitary confinement does to a person. Now, there's been a case study that over 15 days of solitary confinement, a person would start having mental problems. And I saw it happen. The only way I survived solitary was with my Bible.
Let's take another question.
Please, we're down to the last 10 minutes or so. So, if you could keep your question short and to the point.
I'm going to try to keep this short.
And this is really a question, maybe I can't get an answer from y'all, but I need to know, who do I address about making sure that when a person is released from prison, he has a Social Security card, he has his Wisconsin ID, and he has a food stamp card?
Let's see if
it's going out the door.
Let's see if we can get an answer.
Is there a one-stop shop?
Well, I can speak a little bit, too. I mentioned, well, let me answer your question with what I think is a resource, and that's probably Legal Action of Wisconsin can probably assist you with that. Now, WCS, Wisconsin Community Services, also works with people coming back from Racine, and we help them to get all those vital documents. So there are resources. I would say if you need to contact someone right away, you can contact me, and I can get you in touch with other folks who can help the people that you believe need to be assisted.
And we want to remind you, that outside in the room to the right, there are a lot of services that can help you with problems like that or direct you to the services that you can find. So you can ask the questions right here tonight of some of the folks who are outside in the next room.
This con needs that coming out the door, not next week, not 2 weeks later, coming out the door.
Right.
Project Return may be able to help in that situation, coming out the door. Project Return does go inside the prisons and assist prisoners.
Okay. Hi, my name is Jackie Ivy. I'm the outreach coordinator for Milwaukee Transit Riders Union, and I would like to see transportation part of this type of conversation. And like the brothers who come out of prison and told them they come out and they're asked to look for a job. But when report after report has stated that over 40,000 jobs are available in the outlying area, and like the brothers coming out of prison as a transit rider, I feel locked up just as well because we can't get to the jobs in the outlying area. So if transportation can also be part of this conversation as we look for solutions to better this whole state and city. Thank you.
And I think it's worth mentioning that the news came just today that several transit routes have been restored to the suburbs in exchange for the highway construction that's been going on.
So little steps, little steps.
My name is Lauren Brown, and I've worked in various aspects of the criminal justice system, prosecutor, defense attorney, guardian ad litem for juveniles. Also worked with the law school, UW Law School, in terms of the legal assistance program. I'm saying that because I've got quite a perspective. I've also looked at this issue for a number of years, and historically, as we all know, Wisconsin has been in the top five for years. Okay, so we've instituted programs. I want to mention two in particular with Madison Area Urban Ministry and Project Return. The issue of the ID, Mom was able to get the Department of Transportation, another state agency, to help people get state IDs before they leave prison. Mom has a program called the Returning Prisoner Simulation, where now the program goes into prisons and let offenders know what it's going to be like the first 30 days. Because there's a lot of grandiose fantasizing about how people's lives are going to change when they come out of prison. It doesn't always happen. Two things really quick in terms of solutions. We've looked at decision points, both in the juvenile and the adult system. We have a lot of information. It's time to act on it. The state of Wisconsin has a couple of laws. There's one law that's been on the books for a long time that provides tax credits and incentives to employers who hire ex-offenders. Back in the day when the face of criminal justice and corrections looked differently, those programs were alive and well, and they were funded very well. They still exist on the books, but they're not being utilized. Also, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I'm more familiar with that institution, provided basically tuition waivers for men and women in minimum security to attend classes at UW. Earlier, someone from WIBIC was here, Wisconsin Women Business Initiative. In Madison, they offered classes on a partner basis with Mom for men and women who want to start their own business. What is it like to be an entrepreneur? And if we look historically in the black community, we did take care of ourselves. So we did things, we were self-sufficient, but there were resources that were available. So I think we should look at some of the things we used to do. Funding is always an issue. But as a community, we have to step up and be creative and be resourceful ourselves. And I know that that's a challenge for communities.
And I hate to cut you off, but it sounds like you're a resource too. Yeah. So maybe you have some information you can share with other folks when we finish tonight. Thank you very much for coming along.
Hi, my name is Faisha Parker. I would like to say hi to Joanne Williams and give a shout out to my instructor, Nicole Todd, and all the students that are here from MATC. But my problem is I am a young lady that did grow up in poverty or whatever, and a lot of these programs and stuff that these people offer to these children with disabilities and stuff like that, or children going into child welfare, you have these social workers that are coming to talk to these children and therapists coming into our homes and stuff like that, but they never even walked in our shoes or even experienced any of the things that we experienced. They've never know what it's felt like to have to eat ramen noodles every day or to have seen your mother get beaten and stuff like that. And we as children, we look for people to come to us that has actually walked in our shoes or actually know what it feels like to experience things like that. You cannot come to me and tell me that your book or because you have a degree in something, you know how I feel, or you can help me because you've never even experienced it before. And they give those kind of jobs to people with a degree and they don't have that type of experience. They've never experienced that ever in their life. And that's a big problem that our community faced, because I have had therapists come into my household because my mother, she was a drug abuser. My father was a drug abuser. There was domestic violence and stuff going on in my household. And they have 14 children together. I am the fifth child out of 14. And all of these therapists that came and spoke with us, they really couldn't help us because, like they said, they've never gone through it, so they don't know how it feels. So how can they help us?
I want to get a brief response, and maybe David Pate is the person to speak to this. Are the right people or the wrong people serving these neighborhoods?
I wouldn't say, I mean, there's no clear cut right or wrong. I can definitely appreciate what the young woman had just said. And one thing that we do at UWM, and we just had a conversation about this today, as to how we have to train our students to be more empathetic and understanding of the population that we're working with, but also we have to be empathetic and understanding of our own student population. So I think that I would love to talk to that person afterwards, because it would help me as a professor there who trains students how I could do a better job. And one thing I want to say is that it's important that we try to get to know each other. For example, I'm someone who was a homeless kid from age 9 through 12. I lived on the street, me and my three brothers. So you can't really, it's important to figure out who are you talking about and who are you talking to. And I think until we all figure out who everybody is, this is not going to change. We have to figure out how do we develop a community to understand where people came from, where they're going, and how we can each help each other to be better. And I just really want to emphasize that, because she said something really important, but I think oftentimes we don't take enough time to also talk to each other to figure out how can I make it better. You know, I empathize with Chief Flynn, even though I may have differences with what he's saying, but I do understand there's a certain law people have to follow. So again, I would love to talk to that student afterwards.
We're walking a fine line here, because our panel's scheduled to wrap up right now. However, we have so many people that are still in line. There are some of our panelists who have other commitments. So as the remaining people, we aren't taking any more people in line. As the remaining people have a chance to give their comments or ask questions, be aware that some of our panelists may disappear throughout the next couple of minutes. We also want to mention that the resource tables will be open until 9 o'clock in the room that is to your right as you leave the auditorium. But let's go ahead and take another question.
Hi, my name is Monica Rida, and I'm a politics editor in Chicago, where they recently decriminalized, which is more like a year ago, they decriminalized marijuana possession. So if you have a small amount of marijuana, rather than getting arrested and going to the Cook County Jail, you get ticketed. This is still a flawed approach, because reporting from various news outlets in Chicago has shown that even though white people still use drugs, and I have spoken with plenty of people in the city of Milwaukee, and if you ask basically a lot of white students who go to UWM and probably also at Marquette, I've only spoken to the ones at UWM, They can tell you what's the best pot, who has the best pot, and who has the best drugs. So it's not the young, poor black people who are getting arrested who know this. It's the white people. Even though black people are getting arrested and getting ticketed for pot possession at a higher rate. So I'm not sure who would be best equipped to answer this question, but do we maybe need to change how we are policing? So rather than addressing the areas that have a higher victimization rate, we address all of the areas and maybe work with campus security to address these people who are actually using the drugs.
Chief, I know you have a prior commitment, but if you want to take a stab at
well,
that
sure.
Answer.
We're aware of that possible imbalance, and it concerns us. The propensity to sin is equally spread across all components of society, regardless of race, ethnicity, or certainly income. All right, we can all agree about that. But public space violent crime has historically been the province of the poor. Now, you might notice my last name. Did you ever stop and ask yourself why prison wagons are called paddy wagons? Those were my people in the back seat for about 80 years. And the challenge for us is this. We are heavily engaged in the highest crime neighborhoods trying to be proactive. What did we notice in the first couple of years when we started using traffic enforcement as a way to create a strong presence in the neighborhoods? Well, first of all, we started with a rule which said, give a warning if you possibly can. And 80% of our traffic stops are a warning. All right, they're traffic violations. They're legitimate stops. The goal isn't to get a consent search to make an arrest. We're not out there trying to make drug arrests. But what we found was we were getting them through consent searches. So we tightened the rules on consent searches. We have stronger rules now on consent searches than are required by law. We're basically holding the officers to the same standard of getting a warrant. Why? The goal isn't to get more drug arrests. The goal is to have an impact following research that's been done around the country. If regular officers heavily engage in traffic enforcement in the highest crime neighborhoods, there will be a direct impact on street robberies and car thefts. We have seen that. That's the goal. We have a moral obligation to keep people from being robbed and shot, and there is no denying the fact that that public space violent crime most heavily occurs in our most disadvantaged neighborhoods. So to the speaker's point, we are trying to de-emphasize street-level drug arrests because that's not the goals of our encounters. The goal of our encounters is to reduce the level of violence, and we've had some significant progress, but there's still too much of it.
Okay.
No matter what I say, then I won't say anything.
We appreciate your comment and your passion.
People who have been lined up for a long time.
Let's let the folks who've been waiting ask their questions, and we understand.
My name is Africa Imani, and I want you to remember my name, especially Chief Flynn. I wasn't even going to speak about this until I saw him. Excuse me, it's a little bit too close to me. Until I saw him when I first came in. I saw him at an event a few weeks ago. I'm the mother of three murdered children. One of my sons, Ali Imani, has, for 14 years, this case is quote-unquote unsolvable. But from the mouth of one of your detectives, Kathy Hines Spano, to my ears, told me that the suspected murderer of my child, my 24-year-old son, is a snitch for your police department, and that the police and detectives don't trade information. So I'm not asking you, I am demanding you and commanding you to be accountable for your staff, because here I am, 14 years later, as of April 29th, without any resolution to this case. There will never be closure. But someone needs to be held accountable, and your detective should not be telling me, you know, he's a snitch, and we know he's a snitch, but the police don't, we don't trade information like that.
Thanks.
Just 1 second. I have another son who was murdered. 9 months before this son, 9 months to the date, who is a young man who I go to see in prison. I've talked to him. I have forgiven him for killing my son. Shot him in the back 3 times with a sawed-off shotgun. But I forgive them because I'm a God-fearing woman and God is merciful to me. But he has shown me that he has done everything that the prison system has asked him to do, and they still keep him locked up. I go see him. I write to the parole board requesting his demand, his release every time he's up for parole. They never give me an answer why they won't release him. And I wish somebody was here from the DOC because this has to change. I am a victim, or I am the victim, I am the mother's victim. And if I'm asking for his release, why shouldn't the prison system release him? This is a young man who was done a stupid thing when he was 26 years old, who's 42 now. And he needs to be released. His daughter was 8 years old when he went in, and she's 22 or 23 now. He needs to come home. Thank you.
Let's take another question.
My name is Devon Jackson. I was framed by one of your officers. His name is Mitchell Ward. I was, the paperwork was doctored. I had no drugs, no guns, no anything. Because I went and worked with them, I was eventually convicted. I went to Internal Affairs and tried to get them to investigate the matter, but they treated me as if I was nobody. So what's, you know, what can I do about that?
We'll get with you after this and get your information.
Thank you so much. And again, let's try to, as much as we can direct these questions towards solutions regarding the incarceration crisis, let's keep those questions focused.
My name is Bishop Rashid L. from Overcomers Temple One. Prison, y'all have stopped education in the prison system. So that's why people are going back to jail. I hear the people talking about taking them in when they come out. If you educate them before they got out, you'll be all right. You wouldn't have to go through all this. They wouldn't be falling back in the cracks. My partners, when they went to jail in the 70s and 80s and the 90s, they all got bachelor's and master's degrees in prison, and they never went back. So you took education out. So y'all want the people. See, that's the biggest money system in the world, is the prison. So y'all want them in jail. See, everybody talking about what's the solution, you already know it. Put the money on the wood, make the bed good. We ain't got no time for this. Y'all all heads, the governor, Mayor Barrett, since they've been in office, we went down in prison. They still talking about what they doing. Nothing. And as far as your police, there's no black police over in my area at all. And why do, when I'm in the back seat, your police stop somebody, they got to ask me for an ID and want me to sit on the curb. I'm 54 years old. I'm not sitting on the curb. Then they want to lock me up because I tell them to respect their elders. Because you got a lot of young boys on the force, don't respect their elders. And one thing about me, I fear nobody. And your office came in my house unruly. I had to call the supervisor. He came in and told, get up out of this man's house. They was out of order. They're out of order. They try to make people sit on the curb. What am I on? You stopped this man for a traffic. I'm not driving. Why are you messing with me? Do I look like somebody? Then I can see you asking me. Okay, you said you look like somebody. Okay, here go my ID. But don't harass me and I'm in the back seat. Why y'all doing that? Last thing, my deacon was driving my car. White man, black man. They pulled us over, said my high beams was on. That's why they pulled me over. Well, I drive a brand new car. The high beams come on only when it's dark. They come on automatically. I don't have to touch no high beams. So that was a lie. See, because he seen a black man and a white man together, they stopped us. My high beams come on automatically. So I didn't cooperate with them. They want to arrest me. I said, do what you got to do, man. Peace.
We just have a couple more people left in line, but I wanted to ask Clarence Johnson the issue about education in prisons. I mean, you deal in workforce development while people are still incarcerated. Are people coming out of prison just not, I mean, how much would the system benefit from enhanced education within the prison system?
Well, I think the bishop was right on in terms of historically, one of the things that happened is that when you went into prison, you had access to education, whether it's a high school, GED, or higher education. That doesn't exist. It's not as prevalent anymore. And then, unfortunately, I think what's happened currently is that when you get out, the focus is on getting a job, which we absolutely understand that that's important. But the fact of the matter is that unless you're able to improve yourself academically with an education, your ceiling is very low in terms of getting to higher wages and higher earnings. So education should be much more of a goal than it actually is now. And we would support, I'm sure that my WIB colleague would and others would support, a refocus on education, not just getting that job, but also making sure that your career path is expanded because you have access to trainings and to education, which will help you sustain yourself down the road in the future.
Hi, my name is Crystal Franklin, and I just have one comment. In my opinion, whenever you suspend, in my opinion, the school-to-prison pipeline, it needs to be stopped. Whenever you suspend a child in K-5, a form of violence has been committed against that child.
And in retrospect, it seems as though someone in the education system would be well served to be involved in this conversation.
Hi, my name is Brianna Howard, an 11th grader at the Milwaukee Academy of Science. And my question is, why is there such a large difference between money spent annually on prisoners than money spent annually on students?
Well, that's a question we've talked about before, and we had that come up before about the amount of money that's spent on higher education versus the amount of money that's spent on prisons. And I think that's something that our legislators are going to have to start thinking about and looking at. And I think that's what some of the people on the earlier panel said is going to happen. They're going to start rethinking where the money goes.
My name is Kurtisha Jackson. I'm also an 11th grader at the Milwaukee Academy of Science. My question is, the last panel spoke about the importance of families. What role can we take to support moms and dads to raise effective citizens if they come from the same criminal background?
How can we support families? What can we do to support families so that their kids don't end up in prison?
Well, as someone who studies family policy a lot, the one thing that needs to be done is that we need to have a variety of things. One, we need to have a social welfare system that supports families. And that, I mean, if a family and also a social welfare system that supports individuals as well. For example, we don't have a good housing policy if someone loses their home. We don't have a good social welfare system in terms of cash assistance. I mean, a lot of these are now seen as very negative terms based on a number of political agendas that have gone on in this state and in this country over the last 20 years. But we need to really figure out, when we say family, what do we really mean? I just was talking to someone the other day about I really needed 7 people to raise my kids. And I still need people to raise, because it's a hard job raising a son and a daughter, and particularly a black boy in this country. It's the one thing I worry about, and on every given day before I go to sleep, I'm hoping my kid's okay. And I do care about my daughter, but I really am worried to death about my son every single day. And I think that I have the benefit of having a salary and a good job, as a matter of fact, as they would say. So I'm able to take care of my kids, but a lot of supports are not in place that allows us to really allow people to parent their children in a way that we want all of us to parent our child. And I think if everyone thought about that, it would be a different place. And we would also vote for different people, and we would make our vote count. And I think that we should also. The last thing I'm going to say is I spent last semester in England. As part of my sabbatical, and I looked at their social welfare system, and it's amazing to see the difference and to hear how they think about Americans. And at that given time, we were fighting over the Affordable Care Act, and it was embarrassing to be an American at that time in England when they couldn't understand why we wouldn't want people to have access to health care when it would make us a stronger country. Why wouldn't we? Why do we have so many? And that BBC story came out when I was there. And everyone was asking me to speak at some university about why do you guys have such a high rate of incarceration? And I think that we need to take a good look at ourselves and figure out where we want to go and how we want to make a difference in society and for our communities.
And I think that's a very good wrap-up.
Yes, and before everybody gets up en masse and walks out the door, first of all, we want to thank all of our panelists.
especially because they stuck around for a good 15 minutes longer than they were scheduled to. We know some of them have other obligations, so we really are appreciative.
And before we end tonight, we want to remind you that even though the radio and television series in this Project Milwaukee will soon be concluding, both MPTV and WUWM will continue to report and to bring you stories to bring to light these important issues in our communities. And I think we've gotten some very good ideas tonight for stories that we can pursue.
With that in mind, WUWM is launching a web project called I'm More Than My Record, featuring the photos of and short interviews with the formerly incarcerated and families of men who are currently incarcerated. If you'd like to participate as you leave the forum tonight, please see one of the journalists in the master's room, which is to the left as you exit.
We want to give a big thank you to the Milwaukee Public Library, our partner in tonight's special event. Please be sure to visit the library's table that's in the resource room to the right as you go out the doors. You can learn more about the library's services, and you can even sign up for a library card tonight right out there. You can also visit the organizations that can offer some services for people coming out of prison or information for families of people who have been inmates.
There are many, many other people we should thank for their support in making this event and the series a success. We'll never get to all of their names tonight, but we should mention the work of several key people.
Everett Marshburn, who was instrumental in focusing the work done in Milwaukee Public Television.
And Annalise Henzel lived and breathed the Project Milwaukee series for the last several months at WUWM, and none of this would be the success it has been without her efforts.
So thanks, yes. So we want to give a thanks to the staffs of both MPTV and WUWM for their hard work on this project, and thanks to all of you in the audience tonight for being here. An edited version of tonight's forum will air Friday morning at 10 o'clock on WUWM's Lake Effect, and you're going to see an edited version of this on Black Nouveau on MPTV in the coming weeks. So we hope you watch, we hope you listen, and we hope you do something. Thank you and good night.